Hey everybody, Michael Thiessen here for Open Mic with Michael Thiessen, and today I get to interview Chuck Mignonette. And maybe if we were closer to Quebec, Chuck might pronounce that Mignonette, but the fact that Chuck is an American pilot or flew with the American Air Force, you guys have Americanized it, and that's great. Thanks for coming on, Chuck.
Pleasure to be here, Mike. Thanks for having me.
So I'm really excited to interview you. Last week we were scheduled, and we had to reschedule for this week, and I've been waiting all week to have this conversation because I have a great respect for those of you men and women who fly for our air forces, for you, the American Air Force. And my dad flew in the Canadian Air Force. He used to do DC-9 pilot transportation and communications back in the Cold War days. And so we'd love to talk to you about what's going on. So, Chuck, why don't you describe for our listeners why you and I are talking today, particularly around the topic of vaccinations in the context of flying?
Sure will. We're talking because it all started basically with mandates. Mandate for the U.S. DOD rolled around about August in 2021. To take the vaccination. Now, in that mandate, you know, there's a process. And, you know, the military, if there's one thing that we're good at, Mike, you know, I had 25 years in the military, was fortunate enough to have command of a squadron and then later a naval air station, which a good number of people. So you go through that process of readiness. And one of those tickers is medical readiness. And as you can imagine, through, you know, three decades approximately of that, you see a lot of things roll down the pike. And so you're measured as a commander or as a unit for, are you ready to deploy, supposedly? By what, how much, you know, have you had the flu shot? Have you had yellow fever, hepatitis, you name them. And then things get added down the road when they see another threat that they see might be for their troops. And so we're real good at pushing things downhill to count numbers to enforce things and that are considered medical readiness. And we've had some over our, you know, the history of the military forces, sometimes we've pushed some stuff down that wasn't so good. Quite honestly, in World War II, we did some things to some folks that we probably shouldn't have done. And I've seen in my lifetime, we had an anthrax vaccinations. It started and it was not ready. It was stopped and then restarted again. And probably inappropriately, in my opinion. And so now we come to this time frame with COVID, and we have a vaccination with emergency authorization use, and then mandates through President Biden, and then mandates to the DOD on a emergency authorized drug or vaccination to be pushed down through the troops. And now, normally, there would be, or there could be, some exceptions, religious accommodations, other administrative accommodations, but there seems to be quite a bit of pressure on this one that is, I've never seen in my lifetime, of the amount of pressure to get these vaccines done and to count the numbers all the way down. So a process gets set up like, you know, if you want to request for a religious accommodation, the services all handle these in individual ways. But, you know, basically you're meeting on a local level, in other words, a base level, with a chaplain that knows your unit, that knows you, and then interviews you to say, what is your request? Do you have a sincerely held request? And then helps that process go up your chain through your command with either recommendation or not. And this occurred in all the forces at different rates. Seemed like the Navy went through theirs a little quicker, and then others would kind of watch and see. But now all those, most of those have gone up and come back with a better than 99%+ denial. So just a kind of a blanket statement, no. Now, there have been some administrative requests allowed, but mostly these have been for someone who's on terminal leave. Terminal leave, for those that might know it, is that, hey, I've reached my retirement date. I've already put in for retirement, and now I'm about ready to get out. So the majority of any accommodations that were given were for those that were going to be out of the service within months' time. But as far as those that are staying in, almost none of those that I can find or have been reported have been allowed if they're going to stay in. Even though at this point in time, the landscape of COVID-19 and where we are and its effectiveness of the vaccines and the Omicron variant and natural immunity that has occurred, nothing has been changed. It's just take the vaccine or we're going to process you. So you get to put your first one in. If that gets denied, you have a chance to appeal it, to look why they said they denied it. So, and many of them were, we don't believe you're a sincerely held belief, even though many times the chaplain who interviewed him said, you did. So it's kind of an upstream political push, obviously, when you've got the chaplain sitting across the table from you, and then you've got someone up in the Pentagon or the headquarters command saying, no, we don't believe it. Unheard of, at least in our history, in the court system here. So then you get to answer their questions, submit maybe your pastors, friends, you know, any other thing you want to address towards why they're not agreeing with your request to an appeal process. Then when that comes back denied, which again, the majority, almost near 100% are getting denied on the appeal process, then your commander gives you a letter, gives you an order, a direct order. You will get the vaccine within said number of days, usually less than a week, 5 days. If you don't get it, you get a letter of reprimand that's put in your record. Here, this is the U.S. military process. And he'll give you another order. Again, if you don't get it, you get a second letter of reprimand, and then you move into what our uniform code of military justice says is an Article 15. Basically, the commander has some authority to take away rank, take away money, take you out of a job and out of position. Now, it is, in our uniform code of military justice, that person, or that individual airman, soldier, sailor, has the right to a court-martial. In other words, I don't want to just be looked at by my peer, my immediate command. I want to make sure I get a fairer look from a court judge or a panel where the rights of or the rules for evidence are a little more stringent than at the non-judicial local. So most of those people are now beginning to select court-martials to be processed. The numbers that we're talking about in the U.S. military are in the tens of thousands that have requested it. Very few to none, except in those cases I talked about. So we're in the middle of that process, but also in the way moving there, we've had several groups of plaintiffs, about 8+ different federal court trials that are now ongoing, where groups of plaintiffs either at a base or a wing or in a service, like the SEALs, the Navy SEALs was one of the first one, and they go file a federal court request basically to take this to court. And so we have those ongoing. Some of those have created injunctions where the federal court magistrate says, that's not the correct word, the judge says, hey, while we're doing this court, we're going to put an injunction. You can't take any legal process on any of these folks at this point in time. So there are some cases where we have injunctions. None of them are, there's only one or two that may be class, full class. So in other words, it says, okay, well, this is for the Air Force or for the Navy, but we're not only going to protect the plaintiffs, but we're going to protect all these sailors under that class. Only a few of those have been gotten at this point in time. However, we're seeking more. A lot of those are seeking full class protection until these court cases are decided. So that's kind of the current where we are. But again, at the same time, while we're there waiting, there's things that are going on, pressure put on young men and young women to just take the vaccination. You're going to lose your career. You're going to lose your retirement. You're going to lose your medical if you don't do this. And this has been throughout the process. And that's what the military, honestly, is pretty good at. You know, I don't want to say it's like a shadow policy. It's a, you know, you've got, you know, the higher ups looking to meet their medical requirements because it affects, according to their evaluation, how good they're doing their job, supposedly. And that's the problem with this, right? So now everyone goes, the pressure increases as it goes downhill. Hey, senior enlisted man, get your guys to get the shot. What's going on? And the things that occur are many times unintentional, maybe well-meaning, but the kind of pressure that's put on it in this environment of already increased depression with this COVID thing and the mask and separation, and all already an increase, a problem in the U.S. military, is suicides, when we see an increasing trend the last couple of years. And so this is what we're doing to our young men and women. We're saying you must take this vaccination or you're going to lose your career. You're going to lose support to your family. And we're basically going to separate you out and make you, walk on the other side of the street. I don't know, the guy with...
No, I was talking to an occupational therapist, and it felt like to her they're treating people like lepers, perfectly healthy people.
Thank you. I couldn't come up with that word. That's exactly what I was looking for.
Yeah. So, Chuck, I was particularly reading an article about an Air Force base near Omaha, Nebraska, where there is. Is this where the group of SEALs is, where they're in their preliminary injunction, or is this where the RC-135 pilots are?
That would be the RC-135 pilots. That's the base, the lone base where that entire wing is there in Omaha. So that is the plaintiffs. A good bit of those plaintiffs are specialists in that aircraft, the RC-135. That's correct.
So can you describe for our civilian audience, I've got a little bit of the facts in front of me about that situation. RC-135 is a reconnaissance aircraft. It also out of that is the KC-135, which is a refueling aircraft, and that flies out of Kansas. Maybe they're in the same class. I don't know. You can talk about that. But basically, you've mentioned that there are tens of thousands of U.S. American military who are asking for exemptions and being denied, and now in some type of process or request towards a court-martial. I can't even imagine the amount of money that is causing the system. But in this particular case, if these 17 pilots are kicked out of the military, it costs something like $5.5 million to train one of these pilots. And that would total $93.5 million in training to replace these highly skilled pilots. Can you talk to that story, and then even broader, if you've got information about just what type of effects is this having on the system?
That's what's amazing. I mean, some of these are young folks, but many of them are, you know, highly qualified, already at the top of their rates. And so, like you said, and that number, that's not an exaggeration. That's even on the low side. Okay, so it takes a pilot in the Air Force or in the Navy or Marine Corps or Army, wherever you want to say it, it's going to take him a couple of years to even get initial qualification. So that's him, the plane, the support people, the maintenance. If it's a carrier pilot, like an F-18, it requires him to go out to a carrier. So you deploy a couple thousand people on a carrier in order to get him carrier called on a couple of different times. So you're talking about over 2 years, and that's just initial. Now take him up to the higher, at the 12 to 15 year, they're probably at the max of their qualifications. So now you take the training he's gotten every year to reach those higher levels of mission commander, so to speak, because, you know, in the rivet joint, there's a good-sized crew. There's electronic warfare officers, as well as navigators, pilots, so and then linguists, various people, all who've been trained for years to get to where they are. So that 5.5 million, it's not hard to multiply that. If you're multiplying that times the thousands, much less tens of thousands, you know, what kind of numbers are you looking at now? And then we've got a situation where, quite honestly, has our requirement dropped for military folks to be highly trained and ready? And not only that, what about our requirement for people with a high level of moral character and leadership? Who are we, not only their technical skills, but who are we losing as far as the moral background to stand up and say? Because it happens in the military, just like it happens everywhere. Someone gets the idea that, you know, here I am, this war something, and I'm in the middle of it. And who do you want there? You want a man who will say, I am not hitting the pickle switch to drop the bomb, shoot the missile, because I am not sure about the ethical or moral condition of what I'm doing right now. I am going to hold off. And that's what we want to be known for as countries, as Canada, or we don't want to be known for killers. Yeah, we want to be feared in combat. So don't, that's for sure. We want to be capable and strong to defend those who need to be defending. But we also want to be the kind of men and women who take moral stands and in the midst grab their buddy there on the ground in tough fog of war, say, hold it, stop, do not shoot, because there's innocence in front of us. And, you know, that's so there's that financial side. Yes, then we're making a horrible financial decision in a time where recruiting is hard in the U.S., is having a very difficult time to even meet their goals. And who wants to go into the military? He's going to just give you mandates and not listen, quite honestly. But I'm sure there's other reasons. There's many aspects, you know.
Like, conscientious dissension has always been an issue for anyone going into the military. And the point that you make about not only are we losing them and all the training we've put into them, but we're actually losing them. We're actually losing individuals who have risen to the top of their rank for competency and moral character. You know, I think that's something that we're taking for granted, isn't that? Isn't the world taking for granted that the U.S. military will be ethical people?
It is.
The U.S. military, I've been saying this as an outsider, but we're a very close neighbor. But if the U.S. military falls, the world falls. Like if the U.S. military becomes a mindless machine of tyranny, then the world falls. Like the free world falls. It is such an important component. I think many people all around the world go to sleep at night with the assumption that, you know, the U.S. military is not going to turn into the Russian military of the past, not going to turn into the Chinese military. Like, there is a piece that comes about the fact that moral integrity is pushed into the system. So you talked about the higher-ups having pressure to push down on this, but am I wrong in assuming that there's also been a great push up the ranks to excel and have merit based upon your ethical and moral behavior?
Well, that's what we're always told, right? I mean, what are the components that, you know, a lot of times, you know, the military services will have? What are our most valued, what are our core values in the Navy? Honor, courage, and commitment. How can you teach those? How can you preach those if in today's environment where it seems to be a lack of trust and a top-down push that just doesn't listen to the guy? So many times I've had good mentors, incredible military leaders, and incredible men and women under me. And it was always, emphasized to me, listen, get down there. You know, you don't have an office. Now you reach command. You don't live in your office. You live out there listening to the troops, because that's what good leaders do. Now, when they have to, they take stands. But they take stands fiercely loyal to the people they're leading, that they would not guide them in the incorrect manner, that they would inform them about what we're doing. It's amazing what the military man and woman will do for you if you define the mission. Here's what we're doing. It's worth doing. And if it becomes not worth doing, I will tell the people above me, and I will not. I'll either have to step down or move out. And that's what I don't understand what's happening now. Where are the leaders that say, not on my watch? I will not exercise this order. Remove me. And take my, you know.
I have heard so many people in different fields say the exact same thing. So, of course, I have been saying that for the churches. Where have the shepherds been to say, not on my watch? My people don't have their consciences violated and their medical consent ignored on my watch. Where are the medical professionals, the hospital administrators saying, not on my watch? We're not going to. And you're saying the exact same thing in the military. There seems to be a crisis of ethical, moral leadership to be able to say, not on my watch. There just seems to be a lemming, like a great run towards the cliff.
And that's, I think, the part that scares me the worst. And what cliff are we running towards? It seems that we're running towards a cliff that a small elite group makes decisions that aren't transparent, that seem to change day to day, and yet don't really take the information from the, so on this vaccine situation, they're not taking the information from the troops on the ground. So the frontline medical doctors, they're here in the U.S. military, there have been whistleblowers. They don't last very long because, you know, they're pushed aside and not listened to. And yet they're the ones that I want to hear from. I think that the military man has the right to hear from. And that's kind of the sad part too. So that's the scary part, is it just seems to be a complete push down, ignore all voices, taking them away, any dissenters, and not take that into account, and to realize that we've moved forward too. Whatever you want to say about the mandates, which I highly disagree with, when have we updated our look at what's happening? Good leadership looks at what's really occurring with his people. Now, you know, and can humbly back off and say, you know, maybe we weren't exactly right. And I see a total lack of humility or willing to listen in this current political environment that I can't listen to other voices. And that, to me, is a sign of such weakness. You know, a man that has to always be right and can't be told he might have been wrong and can't listen, you know, that we keep hearing, let's listen to the science. Well, yeah, but how about listen to the people that are scientists, that have their feet on the ground? And so that's the scariest part to me, that it is top-down driven, and you can't dissent. You can't even respectfully dissent and offer information and from the people. And I mean, if you, as a warrior, as a commander, if I do not listen to my guys whose boots are on the ground, what right do I have to lead, quite honestly? And I think that is where we are right now. I understand that leaders have to make tough decisions in the military. And sometimes, and many times, we take risks that involves people's lives in the midst of conflict. But when we confuse where we are, and that's what we're doing, and that's what I believe has taken place in the name of medical readiness. We've let the wrong people grab the reins.
It's interesting that you talked about being confused about where we are. If you get disoriented and you keep making poor decisions, you lead your people into harm's way. I wanted to talk to you about that whole idea of listening. And, you know, so often you're getting your intel off of the ground. Is not the case in the military? You're getting intelligence from people who are on the ground. So it's my understanding that the military at least did one significant study following two groups. One that followed all of the mandates, and I'm not sure if this was early enough that it included a vaccination or didn't. I tried to look for the article while you were sharing there for a second, because the article is quite old. And then another group that wasn't following the mandates at all. And I thought that study was fairly conclusive that the spread of COVID-19 and the effects of the spread were fairly similar among both groups.
Yeah. Well, I don't recall that article myself. I wish I'd be interested in it. But what we definitely have seen, what we certainly have seen, is the effects on, when the vaccination initially came out, what was the comment? Well, this will basically 95% efficacy, and, you know, it'll just be amazing. Right. And then, well, not so amazing there. You know, you can get it. Things will come through. But the vaccine's good because it keeps you from serious disease and reduces the number of mortality. Right. And there's a lot of bleed through. And then, of course, we went through the different variants, original and then Delta, which was kind of scary. Right. And that's when vaccines were pushed hard. But we also saw at the same time a bearing of other treatments, prophylactic kind of treatments, those that could help, just a bearing of those and any information to go with that. But now, where are we now? Well, we've had the Omicron variant push through the majority, it pushed through the vaccines, pushed through just about anything, right? And yet we've not come back and provide immunity, natural immunity, that's at least as good as the vaccinations and maybe longer. And now that we're into the boosters, we're seeing boosters that last maybe 6 weeks. And yet we continue to get the high-priced answers. And no look back to saying, you know, well, do you have the antibodies? Well, why in the world do I need a vaccine at this point then? But it just doesn't make sense, because there is harmful, no matter what you want to argue about how harmful is the vaccination, it does have some harmful side effects. So why are we looking at this? Oh, go ahead. Yeah. No, that was kind of where I was. It's just, why haven't we gone back and looked and included, okay, well, you didn't get the vaccine because it wasn't available to you yet. You came down with it, or you had bleed through. And so now let's check to see what immunities you have and what antibodies you have, and make decisions off of that. Isn't that the smart thing to do? Because I could harm you even more with a vaccine. I mean, we know that. So what are we doing? We're not making any decisions. We're writing a policy that's politically driven without making on-the-ground decisions that make the most sense, both for the health of our troops and for the cost, and just being good, smart with what we're doing, with our assets. And our assets are humans, our people on the ground, boots on the ground, people flying planes. Let's not do them any more harm than we have to. Let's value that.
Yeah, that original say that I was referring to was more about containment. And I think it was pre the vaccine being rolled out. But now, just typing in U.S. military study about COVID-19 article, heart inflation after COVID-19 shots higher on Reuters.com, myocarditis following immunization with mRNA on PubMed. You're seeing, like you said, new information come forward that there is needed humility and there is a needed needed change of course, even if you had sincerely held beliefs in what you were doing. It reminds me of a story. I listened to a podcast a number of years ago called The Cold War, Prelude to the Present. And it's the story of John Boyd and the development of the F-16. Mm. And how in the mid to late 1950s, Boyd would go out and challenge fighter pilots that he could get behind them in 40 seconds. So you would start behind him, and it was over the green spot over Nellis Air Force Base. And if he could get behind you in 40 seconds, he'd buy you a steak dinner. And no, wait.
The reverse. Yeah.
It was the reverse.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Tell me the reverse. I flipped it.
Right. If you start behind him, so you have the advantage.
Yes.
Right? And in 40 seconds, he says, I can get behind you where I have the advantage to put a missile or guns on you.
Right. Right. And so he always got his, right. And he never had to pay out. So the way I got it confused was that he did all the work and he still didn't get paid, but he didn't ever have to pay out. And so I was thinking he should have gotten paid for that hard work. But there's this story, of course, where he, I guess, was test flying the F-111. And that was it Henry Hilliker's from General Dynamics Design? And there's interaction where John Boyd comes into a bar and just basically tears apart the sluggishness and the design of the airplane. And the podcast commentator says, and Harry Hilliker did one of the bravest thing anyone had ever done. He sat down and said, John, let's talk. And that's how eventually the development of the F-16 came out.
Wow.
Teachability,
yeah.
Changing of plan. Can you imagine if that engineer refused to learn that lesson?
Yeah, and I think maybe it's because, at least here in the U.S. now, I'm sure you're aware, that there's just such a divisiveness. So one side can't even listen to the other, it seems like. So this is our political statement. And so here we are, this politician made this decision, so it's being run down the road. And God forbid, should you disagree with it. We have people like that in the military right now. If you maybe have heard of Lieutenant Colonel Teresa Long, who was doing studies as a medical doctor, and she was aviation side, and when she started seeing the harms, she brought it up, and you know what? Immediately, no, just cut her off. Don't you? And even almost threatened to the point of, don't you become a whistleblower? Don't you say these things? So she says, and she's not alone. We got Lieutenant Colonel Pete Chambers. Same thing. He says, I'm going to give this vaccine to the troops, but they're going to get informed consent, and I'm going to give them brief of what the possible impacts are. And out of 3,000 soldiers, only 6 took it when they got informed consent. So why aren't we listening to some of those people? It seems like there's absolutely no ability right now, no humility on the decision. But quite honestly, often that's the way you want the military to work, right? So it has some advantages. You know, you put an order in at the top and it gets pushed down to the bottom. And by God, you're going to do it. And, you know, it's sometimes that makes sense in the war. Like, you know, you have to, as a commander, you have to say, someone knows something I don't know. Like intel, what? And we've been told we've got to hit this thing in a combat situation. But man, when you have time to sit back and look at something, you know, this is not a war situation. In fact, most of these, here's the problem. One big problem I have is they says, hey, you know, we lose all combat readiness if you don't get everyone vaccinated. But here's the problem. Most of these people have been deployed over the last year and a half into combat with no loss of mission readiness. And yet they say, oh, we can't do it. Well, you already did it. So something's not right here. And at this point in time, if you really looked at those people, I would say 90% of them have some form of immunity, whether it's vaccination or actually having COVID-19, because the vaccines didn't keep the bleed through. So So stop and take a look. Instead of kicking out 15, 16,000 people of hard-earned experience that you spent literally probably billions of dollars training in a time when you can't even meet your recruitment levels, and leadership is what you need. It just doesn't make any sense. It's just, you know, shooting your foot off, and it's a shame.
How far does that tension go with the top-down command from boots on the ground intel? Like in a normal combat situation, like I hate to say it, but you know, right now I'm thinking of movies, and I hate even to admit to my listeners that the image but it's just so profoundly, you know, the same type of movie is made, you know, the president and a few people know best and they are pushing it, or you've got the guy on the ground trying to come up the chain going, no, you've got it all wrong. And it seems like a very sincere tension. I don't think that I would have ever chosen a military occupation for that one reason. Like that, if I am I hope to be a moral man. I hope to be an ethical man. I also have no problem with combat. I have, you know, I'm a full just war theorist. What is it like in the, like, how is that tension resolved normally, particularly when we've put such confidence in the American military?
Yeah. There's a lot of different ways it rolls down, but in general, we're talking about what we call commander's intent. So, you know, what are we trying to do here? So, you know, we want to take out these, combat critical, that oftentimes we find ourselves in this direction. We're trying to take down something that's combat critical, maybe terrorist cells, maybe something, but the commander's intent will be, well, we don't want to kill any civilians in the process. We don't want to lose our own people in the process. So it kind of comes down with that kind of shell of here's the commander's overriding intent, what we want to see happening. And so then the various units, the intel, the, you know, trying to figure out what targets we hit, how do we best get it done and get on the ground. Hopefully at that point they're listening to those strategic planners that have experience on the ground or are in contact with troops, like what's the best method to get it done. But then it still, even the best planners, the best plan, you know, so you get in the middle of the mission, you're like, what they thought this was, it isn't. And we could kill civilians or we could lose a good number of troops in this process. So decisions then have to be made. And they have to be made in the fog of war, in the thick of it, and sometimes in split seconds, a moment. So do I pull this trigger or not?
At what level is that commander communicating back far up the chain? Like what you just described there sounds like a commander on the ground, if he assesses a situation, the situation has changed based upon the intelligence that have come in, and now we're in a different situation, the commander on the ground gets to make the call.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sometimes, so you're going to come back from that mission or go back to your base or return, and you're going to have immediate feedback. What's the battle assessment? What did you find out? What was the issue? Well, that was the wrong target. Well, sometimes it was too late. I've been in the plane situation over a country in Europe, and we hit the right target, the one that was given us, but it was the wrong target. It did not have anything of combat importance, and fortunately, it was unmanned at the time. And, you know, you're kind of like, it's frightening at times, but mistakes do happen in the middle of combat. And so that goes back to me, like, wrong target. Come on, guys, fix it. Let's make sure we know what we're doing. Fortunately, we didn't kill anybody, you know. But so it gets pushed back up the command pretty quickly. How much listening is done? That's a good question. It depends on who's up the command, who's willing to listen. And maybe in sometimes, like in my position at CENTCOM, when I was electronic warfare there, I said, I'm hearing this, let me go talk to the platoon, the battalion commanders. Let me talk to them and find out what's going on, because their people are getting killed by IEDs and RCIDs. Let's find out and let's get the answer. So that's the kind of engagement you need, and oftentimes you do. But on these big political policies, it seems like there's, right now, there is no listen back. If there is listen back, it is inevitable, at least from the ground position. In fact, it seems just continuing push around, kind of shadow policies. Hey, separate those people over there. They're the lepers. You know, they're the unvaxxed. Don't listen to them. Remove them from command. Remove them from their responsibilities. And so that is just it's not working.
Are you concerned that there is a cleansing being done of moral, ethical actors? Like, when you describe the situation, Chuck, it reinforces, you know, so much of the need for that honor, right? When you honor, courage, commitment, like, honor is such a requirement for any type of ethical warrior, for any type of ethical actor, and adjustment, whereby, like, you do have this tension where the warrior goes out and does the job, but if he comes back and says, we're doing the wrong job, in order for the mission to remain in ethical and intact, and that would mean, you know, we can equate the word ethical with, virtuous, and not just a political game, but actually for a good, just reason. Yeah. It's so critical that the information goes back up. And so, are you concerned that this tension of strong individuals who will follow commands, but also with a strong feedback up the chain, like, are they being targeted? Is that the purpose? You know, just gut the American military of moral individuals and get them to just have robotic players from top to bottom?
Well, I always have a difficulty, Mike, with something that sounds like conspiracy, you know, but conspiracy or not, or in other words, did someone target this? I don't know. I don't think I can't know, but here's the point I guess I would make. What's practically happening? If it's happening, whether it was a conspiracy or not, it's happening. So are we losing 15 to 16 to 20,000, or did we, people? Are we to this? Were these people that were willing to take stands for something that's not all that popular, for the sanctity of life based on sincerely had religious beliefs? Yes. So what will we end up? We'll end up with a less sensitive or less moral, ethical leadership group of experienced people for the next round. What is the next round? You and I don't know, but next time there'll be less resistance to whatever a political kind of policy might be to be pushed down through the force and through the DOD, but not only DOD, so DOD also, we're talking Air National Guard, Army Guard. Who are those people in the U.S.? So they're a different title under the Constitution. So in a time uprising or problems or emergency, those are the ones that get deployed to enforce. So they can become our enforcers down the line, which you may have already seen in some cases in Canada, where enforcement begins to take place through military forces. So that's the next thing. Now here, it's also, you know, I don't want to say those are the only moral ethical people. There's plenty of Christians that for some reason have not woken up on this line. I don't know why, for whatever reason. And some of those are my brothers and sisters, and I do believe they have a sincere faith. But so I don't want to trash them at all. I just want to say, hey, please wake up and see this for what it is. Don't let this aborted cell, fetus cell, distract you either, or maybe study it and figure out what they're talking about. Maybe you didn't know about it, but pay attention, because it doesn't matter what the next thing is, because now you've removed a significant number of folks that were willing to take a stand. What is the next stand, and who will take their place? Or will they be the one that show up in your city to enforce whatever they've been told to enforce under political, the names and the guise of political correctness, against those that are asking to stand for religious rights?
Yeah, and I understand that tension that you're saying. When I asked that question, do you think that the U.S. military is being gutted? I don't think the question is as conspiratorial in the sense of like just an ideological battle. Like, do you think that people are just happy to be having those who would resist their will, you know, pushed out? And I'm feeling this for every profession. It's incredibly dangerous that doctors can't have open dialogue anymore. My listeners will know that I interviewed a doctor, Mark Trozzi, almost two years ago now. And Mark said, look, I can go talk to somebody about how we do blood transfusions, but I'm not allowed to debate with a fellow doctor about whether or not I have to wear a mask. Like, walking from my car, like I'm going to go talk about whether, you know, we do blood transfusions a certain way, but I'm going to say I disagree with mask wearing, and somehow I don't have the intellectual capacity. And I so much appreciate the vantage point that we've been having this discussion, because I think this issue revolves around individuals with fundamental beliefs that lead to the benefit of all of these institutions. Yeah. And so when you talk about your Christian brothers and sisters who have not woken up, I'm in the exact same realm. I'm really struggling to watch this deception be so effective among the very people that we need to be awake and to join the people who are standing up for fundamental freedoms, for constitutional rights, for basic, well-developed law. And we need more people to join that, because what the alternative is more and more with each, you know, forget about any maybe grand global plans. Just think about what happens when, you know, bad people rise up to higher levels of government with less checks and balances, yeah, with more ability to profit from what they're doing because they don't have any checks and balances. Like, it's just a very simple decay of society.
It is. I mean, the one thing that the military, our oath when we take it, I just want to cover this, because I think it addresses this a little bit. We talk about our oath is to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Well, when we say that, we of course have our First Amendment rights, right, free speech, but included in that thought process is, where do our rights come from? Inalienable rights given to us by God, our Creator. And that's the central key theme of the power behind our Constitution, whether rightly or wrongly used over the years. So each sailor that I ever swore back in, or my own oath, said those same things: against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And that's quite honestly where we are now. These men are defending the very ideology of what America stood for, at least in our minds. And I'm not saying that America is pure in any sense of this, but what we came up with from our founding fathers is pretty awesome, if we'd hold to it. And those are those freedoms that, you know, and I will say we didn't act even against our northern friends in Canada, sometimes maybe in question marks. But
don't worry, I'm an American friendly here. I appreciate your humility, but Canadians have a very younger brother syndrome where we just like to do whatever the US doesn't do simply because we want to have a little bit of a hissy fit, but then we utterly benefit from the vast majority of things that the US does. So
I love my Canadian brothers. We did some military deployments up in Nova Scotia, Halifax with the Blue. Hats off to the Blue Nosers up there. We just love those guys, just wonderful people. So I just getting back to the point is, hey, that's our duty. And unfortunately it seemed like there was a time period for the US where we just fell asleep on this thing. And you mentioned that maybe Canadians, there's just kind of this, a little bit of apathy or falling asleep, like it'll all be okay, you know, and we're so big, I can just live up here, you know, in this my province, and none of what they do down there in Ottawa are going to affect me. And here in the U.S., maybe our midland or our farmlands and those that aren't involved in this on a daily basis say, well, it doesn't really impact me. We're past that.
You know, Chuck, I want to jump off of what you actually just said. These individuals, so like the... do I pronounce it Offutt?
Offutt.
Mm-hmm. You know, these individuals at the Offutt Air Base are actually, this is a form of defending the country.
Yeah.
Isn't it? You take significantly that sentence that you just said, where a medical doctor just simply gave them medical informed consent. Just gave them informed consent and treated them under constitutional and normative medical practices. And you said only
six out of 3,000.
Yeah. 6 out of 3,000. And that is because their rights were respected. And now many of them are turning around, having benefited from that doctor doing the right thing, from making the right decision, they've turned around and said, you know what? We don't want this forced upon us. We don't want this forced upon us. And so this really is, right? When you have the collective or the socialist or the, I dare say, communist worldview of just do what is right for the vast majority of people, and the word right is determined by two people in a room with no disclosure, it really is defending the nation to turn around and say, no, we're based upon our constitutional beliefs, based upon our religious rights under those constitutional beliefs, based upon the information that we've taken in, we will not be forced to do this. It is a real form of defense. And the collective is going to say, no, it's actually undermining the preparedness. And I'm sure you're having the same experience where there's just no evidence of any of that, because that's the same. We're having that experience in Canada. You put one of the government's experts up in a court case and he pales in comparison to what we're finding our defense witnesses will bring as far as medical evidence. It really is a sacrifice and a hardship. It's a different front line. You don't think about these people being on the front lines right now in this issue, but it is actually a line, but it is domestic.
It is. It absolutely is. And you're so right on that. They are defending their rights, which in turn, they're standing for us too. And for the next person down the road that might not even agree with them now. On this particular issue, but that's what freedoms are about. And so that is a very valid point. And that's all I say is, you know, because some civilians will say, well, military people, didn't they give away their constitutional rights? No, absolutely not. You know, there are times that, yes, we would be willing to defend freedom to the point of our own lives, but not to throw away our constitutional rights at any point in time. So in fact, like you just mentioned, there's a double duty, in my opinion, first as a United States citizen and second as a U.S. military man to defend the Constitution. And I hold that dearly above anything else, is to stand up for those that can't stand up, not only in my country, but in some other country where I might be, where their lives are taken as nothing. And yet, as a military man, I look at their lives as a sacred gift of God as well. And so I have to take that ethically and morally and make those decisions, even in the midst of battle where it's most difficult. But certainly back here in our country, for my fellow sailor or soldier, stand up for his rights so that my next generation can also have those freedoms that I so richly enjoyed during my life.
It's absolutely fascinating, the connection logically and philosophically between the idea of they gave away their rights. If that were true, if every U.S. military operator, every Canadian in the Canadian military, if they actually gave up their rights, think about what that would mean for their behavior, because they would go, well, I gave up my rights, you should give up your rights too. And think about how quickly a military would turn upon its own citizens, upon its own individuals, if they really believed, I am only here to serve my commander. Yeah. And what you've been talking about is they're really there to serve the Constitution, which leads them back to the service of the people, which leads them back to the very treasured rights that they have. And isn't that really what we've heard? That's such a socialistic idea. I remember talking to somebody when the trucker convoy was in full swing here in Ottawa, and I was just down the road from where I am right now, I was out getting vegetables at a vegetable stand, and some guy, I like to poke the bear. In Canada, so many people just don't want to talk about issues. So I'm getting vegetables. I'm like, oh man, those truckers are amazing. And the gentleman said, look, I got my poke, so they should get theirs too. And he was operating from that, well, I've given up my rights.
Yeah.
And so they should give up theirs too. Like, if that really was philosophically what a soldier was doing, was saying, my rights are completely void, I don't care about citizenry for myself, think about how logically it would, how easily that flows into, I don't care, really, why would it care about the rights of you either? I'm only here to care about what the military wants me to do, and I benefit from being a part of the military. It turns into a very quick mafioso, it turns into a very quick might is right type of mentality. And it's interesting. I just pushed back on that, on the vendor. I just pushed him back a little bit. Yeah. And I said, so like, what if you were to cut off your arm, if someone forced you to cut off your arm, you think every Canadian needs to cut off your arm? Like no, you were forced to do something. People who are fighting this, the truckers right now, they're actually standing up for you. So you don't have to do that ever again.
Yeah.
And he just kind of puzzled. And I said, yeah, like I obviously disagree with you that we should just do whatever, whether it goes against our conscience. And he thought about it. And we talked about it a number of times since. And we really need these type of defenders, don't we? Man,
yeah.
I'm just very thankful for the way that you've positioned our conversation on a number of fronts.
Thanks. I mean, I just have to give just a couple of examples that we run into in my own lifetime. So the importance of moral and ethical and religious freedoms and the decisions you make. I mean, most people look at the United States military, at least in the United States, and say, hey, if you were going to trust someone, who would you trust? Lawyer, go down the road. A lot of times the military guy rises to the top, that, and that's the way you want it to be. And unfortunately, it's, because I've been there in those situations where someone above me that outranked me significantly said, shoot the missile. And I couldn't verify to my ethical or moral, I wasn't willing to shoot the missile at the enemy, but where was that missile, a missile that goes up to 70 miles? Where is it going to go? And I couldn't verify where it might hit. Is it going to hit a neighboring country or someone else? So I didn't shoot the missile for a few seconds until I was sure. And then I was getting reprimanded by that commander, and it turned around on him. You know, because that's what you expect of the American military man. Hey, guy, boots on the ground, shoot that person. Wait a minute. I don't think he's a terrorist. Well, who do you want there? Who do you want in the policemen's? Who do you want standing guard or enforcing local laws? Someone that understands the rights and freedoms, you know, of the individual? Who do you want as your political leaders? It seems like we've missed this boat here lately. Do they understand what we're talking about and what they're putting at risk in our Constitution, our freedoms, and our religious freedoms, where this is taking the country? If they do, then I'm shocked. I'm shocked at where they're going. Do the Department of Defense leaders, the Secretary of Defense, and the generals on down understand what is occurring here? They must not see the slippery slope that I see, and I'm surprised and shocked, quite honestly. And I would say, if to your listeners, just if you're asleep, wake up. If you're awake, get active. Write, do what you can, inform people. Make the difference. Because that's always, you know, where does it come from? Where does the strength of your nation come from? It's people. Keeping politicians honest, keeping those people honest, questioning them, challenging them. And if we fall asleep as a nation, it will usually go towards those that are in might or have power or have position for their own benefit. That's just history repeating itself over and over again. And that's why I think the Christian leader in the military that answers to an almighty God and not humbly is so critical in that position and in other leadership positions as well. But still, even if they're there, keep them honest. Keep them accountable. As a pastor, right? Even a pastor needs people to be held accountable for. And so it seems like,
and you graciously even put the word in even, and I've been a pastor for 20 years. Forget it. Pastors are just like everybody else. They like to teach the Bible and that's it. Like, that's it. They like to teach the Bible, but it's not even pastors, especially pastors, those who are supposed to be the prophets. What did the Old Testament, when we talk about, you know, Jesus had to bypass the Sanhedrin in the New Testament in order to get to the people, because the Sanhedrin was going to do everything that was wrong. The prophets of Israel were time and time again saying, you know, you love your beer and you love your stomachs more than you love me. The reality of it is that anybody who loves the Lord Jesus, fears the Father, bears the fruit of the Spirit, lives within this tension of being an actor in the theater of war who has to bear witness before God about what they've done. And sometimes that means saying yes. Sometimes that means saying no. Sometimes that means apologizing for an action and changing course of action. Sometimes that is repenting of an action that you can't ever take back. But it is individuals who are not mindless little machines. And Chuck, this conversation has been so clarifying for me, because philosophically and theologically, there's just that little turn that's happened. Rights are selfish. Your rights are not important. And all that leads away from is to a deception that God didn't create individuals worthy to be defended of. Like, it's such a little shift in mentality that goes such a long way to then, you know, just, you know, to use a biblical metaphor in a negative way, just to part the Red Sea for Pharaoh to drive right through and not to be crushed. No, the Lord wants us to act justly and wants us to get to the other side where Pharaoh is trapped and punished for evil. Chuck, just to close our conversation today, could you just share with our listeners your military experience? Because, when we got introduced to one another, I had the pleasure of just, you know, coming to an understanding that you are a pilot and you've had lots of military experience. Can you walk through how you've served the U.S. citizenry over the last number of years? I just want to hear it. I appreciate so much when guys in the military get to tell about all the stuff you've done.
Thanks. I'll start with my grandfather. So grandfather immigrated in 1903. You can see his signature there at Ellis Island. Young kid out of France, turned around as American GI, went back to war. And so he served, you know, to try to liberate his own country that he was from. My father served World War II. His brother died in the Battle of the Bulge. He, thank goodness, returned home. And then I chose to serve. Actually, I was a youth pastor for a few years. And I felt like God had something different for me. And had a father-in-law who was a pilot and some other mentors who were wonderful Christian men. So I went in to the Navy to fly. And it's everyone's dream to fly jets. So I was fortunate enough to get selected to fly jets, and I flew EA-6Bs, which is a twin-engine version, electronic warfare jet, which is kind of fun because it's got one pilot and then a couple of electronic countermeasure officers who are the brains of the deal. I fly the plane around, but those guys are what I call 20-pound heads, amazing people that can see the Matrix, if you've ever seen that movie, you know. And so it's a great mission because you get to, you know, you get to protect. You're involved in everything, but your idea is protecting your force. So I really enjoyed that mission. Was able to be an instructor, flew over 4,000 hours in that plane and about 400 carrier arrested landings. And one of my main jobs was to teach people to land and take off from the carrier. Really enjoyed that. And just God just gave me favor, and I ended up getting command of a squadron, just an incredible group of people. And then from that, I went on to CENTCOM to be their electronic warfare officer. I actually volunteered for that to get some things done. There was a lot of people dying from the IEDs. And so I knew some smart people, had some ideas. And so I went to try to make a difference. And God just provided favor. Oh, sorry. Forgot to turn his phone. And then got selected to be a Naval Air Station commander, which was just, yes, a wonderful time, working with people, just some of the finest folks. I was promoted to the level of captain, which is an 06 in the Navy, quite honestly, because I just had some great people working for me. And just names of people I still keep in touch with. Really blessed to be in that position and be able to fly in several different combat areas because the EA-6B is what they call low density, high demand. In other words, we don't have very many of them, so we're going to send you wherever we have problems. So we were involved in all those conflicts that have been over the last couple decades and deployed in those situations. And fortunately, God, I wasn't like a Navy guy gets a lot of glory flying the planes, but quite honestly, my heart goes out to those guys and boots on the ground. Never lost sight of the fact that that's what our mission was, is to keep those guys safe and get them home because they're the ones really doing the tough work. Navy SEALs, you know, guys that are really taking the the battle to the edge. So just really blessed. And then I retired in 2010 and started teaching high school students how to be a junior ROTC, which I considered a mission field in the public schools. And now I'm retired and chase 12 grandkids around the country. And that's my passion, is working with our grandkids and other young men and women. So
That's wonderful. I'm so thankful for the time that you took to talk to me today. Three more questions. One, for us civilians, how big's a squadron? When you became commander, how many people were you overseeing? So those two questions.
Yeah, about 200 in a squadron, approximately. You gain people as you go back and forth. And then the Naval Air Station, a couple thousand. And you have multiple squadrons on the Naval Air Station. So
both. Okay, and that third question,
yeah.
Are you going to go back to Missionet, or are you going to keep with the Americanized version of it now that you've fully admitted that your grandfather was an immigrant from France? I feel like now you've got to go back.
Yeah. Well, we were scheduled to go back for my granddad, you know, when he wrote letters to my grandmother when he was in World War One, and so we know where he's from, but no one's been back. All the Missionets live here. But we wanted to go back and visit it, but guess what interrupted it? COVID-19. So we will go back, and I'm thankful for my ancestry, French and whoever, and all, but mainly I'm thankful that I had Christian parents.
Amen.
That,
yeah.
Showed
what
me
a blessing it is.
What leadership was.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this has been a wonderful discussion. Look, everybody, please like and share this video. You know, a video can go a long way to help convince people that they need some teachability and they need some change. So if you've got anybody in the U.S. military or the Canadian military who just, you know, wants to say, let's just go along to get along, and they don't understand why individuals are resisting, this would be a great video to share with them. Chuck, it's a great video because you shared so transparently and we got to see your wisdom in it. So thank you for being with us. Everybody, thank you for listening, and Godspeed.
Godspeed, Mike. Thank you.